We're in a series at the moment. We just started a teaching series. Today, we're looking at the important role the church plays in actually being God's agent of meeting the world's needs in practical ways, missional ways, social action ways. God is not interested just in our internal salvation, you know, when he comes and he changes our hearts and he gives us fresh life and fresh hope. He's not just interested in that, he's actually interested in global transformation. And that's one of the things we're going to be looking at today. So, Andrew and Linda, welcome. Come and share with us.
Hello. So, I'm Andrew and Linda. Yeah, that's right. Thank you for the opportunity. So, I'd like to tell you a little bit about an organisation we're involved in and give you a little bit of background on it as well. So, Linda and I celebrated our 30th year of marriage this year, which is pretty amazing. And if you knew us both when we were teenagers, it's utterly amazing. One of the things that has been really deeply embedded in our spirits and our souls is what the church would generally refer to as overseas mission. That is doing Jesus in another country, for want of an easier description, in a myriad of different ways. He's not called us to be missionaries in the traditional sense of the word, of going and living in another country and doing whatever being Jesus is in another country. He's called us to help fund and give to organisations. So that's been really part of our DNA virtually ever since we got married. And it's impacted a lot of who we are and a lot of what we've done and why we do it. So we have been involved in this organisation, ASHA, in India, for what we realised when we were there recently was 25 years of the 30 years we've been married. As part of our 30-year celebration, we were working out what is it that you want to do. You know, most people have big parties and do lots of things, and we have had some very nice things, but we didn't just want to do one thing. We wanted to do loads of things. So we've had some really nice meals out, and one of the things we decided to do was we wanted to go and spend some time with our friends in India, in a developing country, going into slums, meeting people, seeing things, and being friends with people that you wouldn't normally get the chance to do. Might sound slightly odd as a way of celebrating your 30th anniversary, but that's what we decided to do. So we spent 9 days there in February. We've been many, many times before. Ollie and Taylor have been with us many, many times before. And we know the founders of the organisation, who's a paediatrician called Kieran Martin. Some of you may have met her husband, Freddie Martin. He's been here and spoken before. And ASHA are a urban development organisation. They are indigenous. It's run by Indians for Indians. They work in the slums of Delhi. Delhi, I've probably got these numbers wrong. Delhi has a population of somewhere between 15 and 20 million. Somewhere over 5 million of those people live in slums. So that's a fairly substantial number. And India is one of those really weird countries, like many developing countries, where you have the rich and the poor literally living next door to each other. And we do very well in our Western culture where we can segregate it. So you have to choose, for instance, in our area, you have to choose to drive through Castlefield if you want to see a bit of poverty. You don't see very much in Marlow. There, it is literally next door to each other, as it is in many cities in developing countries. So what do ASHA do? They are a Christian organisation through and through. Jesus is at the centre of everything that they do. They are transformative in what they do and highly restorative in what they do. So we've come across quite a lot of organisations that do brilliant work, but they do it to people or for people, if you understand what I'm trying to say. So they might, they might do digging wells. So they'll go into a village and dig a well for the village. What ASHA have done right from the very start is they've just gone in and been with the people in the slum communities and worked out with the people what are their felt needs. So that may not be the most important need in that community at the time from an outside point of view, but if you lived in that slum community, that's the most important thing. And they have worked with them to resolve that problem. I think one of the great things that I like about the organisation is, this might sound rather odd, they politicise people. I was having this conversation with John yesterday, and it suddenly struck me that in our culture, we actually don't understand hope very well, because we don't need to. There are very few people who are in utterly hopeless situations. There obviously are, but there are very few people. So as a culture, we generally don't get hope very well. Asher means hope in the Hindi language, and that is what they've tried to be to these people for this whole generation that they've been running it for the last 30 years or so. So if you like, they do the traditional development work. They do primary healthcare. So in the slums where Asher work, there is now no infant mortality. In India as a whole, infant mortality is still very high. There is no TB, or virtually no TB. There is no polio. That's not the case in the general population in India, because the work that they've done in primary healthcare is outstanding, but they've got the people who live in the slums to own it themselves, rather than them just coming from outside interventions. They do sanitation, they do environmental changes, they do micro lending or financial inclusion. These are things that are very generally held within the development world as helping people with their basic needs. What they've managed to do at Asher is to get people to own it themselves. And this whole idea of politicization something, I don't know. So they will group people together, and they work mainly with women and children. And that is in a very male-dominated society where women are not heard. They don't have a voice. But the women are effectively the powerhouses within the family to keep the families going. They will organise them to actually go and get this stuff themselves. India is one of those very weird countries that they actually put money in their governmental budget to help slum dwellers, but nobody knows it's there. It's very corrupt, as much is within local government in India. And so what Asher have done is they've gone alongside these groups of women and said, you can actually make a difference in your community. And this is where this whole hope thing comes in, because most of these ladies are so, what's the word I'm looking for? Unconfident. They have no belief in themselves whatsoever. I remember the very first time we went into a slum in Delhi, all of the women had their veils across their faces. They wouldn't make eye contact with you. They certainly wouldn't talk to you. When we went in this time, it was very, very different. It's a whole different thing. But Asher have convinced them that they can actually do something. And once they've been convinced they could do something once, you get a little bit of hope. Maybe we could do something again and again and again and again. And Asher have taught these women's groups and these slum communities that they can go and lobby. There's money in the government for them. They can go and get sanitation. They can go and get running water. And it's hard work, and they have to push and push and push. But there's been this huge... environmental change in the 25 years we've been working with them from, I think you'll see some photographs later on, from slums that are literally sticks and plastic to properly built, brick-built communities with running water, with proper sanitation, with concrete paths, and yes, they're tiny little lanes in between houses, and they do the thing we used to do here in the 15, 1600s. Every time you build another layer on a house, you move outwards slightly, so that by the time you get to the third and fourth floors, there's only about a foot between houses, and the alleyway underneath is almost dark now. It's really weird. We used to do that many years ago. One of the things I like about Asher so much is this whole idea that they are there to serve people. And if the local communities don't want to do something, they don't do it, even if it's the best idea in the world. The founder, Kira Martin, has this amazing ability to... it's genius. She has the ability to hold hands with the rich and famous and powerful, so she can walk into most government ministers' offices at very, very short notice. I doubt many of us could do that. Yet at the same time, her hand-holding of people living in the direst of situations is absolutely unbelievable. It's this whole holding hands up and down at the same time. It's absolutely brilliant. Linda and I have funded many, many organisations in the 30-odd years we've been doing this stuff. And Asha is by far, in my opinion, the best example I've ever seen of urban development. So we wanted to show you a video, if you can put that up, and then Linda's going to talk. So thank you very much.
We've just sung a song about asking God, in one sense, to break my heart with what breaks yours. It requires a response. You know, what does that mean? It requires us to do something. It requires us to become something that maybe we're not already. I don't always sing that song, that line, actually, because it hurts really a lot. But going to the slums of Delhi is part of seeing how other people live. You know, this is comfortable. This is really comfortable. This is really nice. And that's not a criticism, but it is. We can think that everybody lives like I do. I want everybody to live like I do, in the sense that, you know, I don't have issues with sanitation. I don't have issues with water. I don't have issues with, a real sense of poverty. So there is a response. There is a response that we can make. Asha have come up with, or Kieran in particular, 10 values that they teach all their kids, and they teach all their students, and they teach all of their women in particular. There are men's groups, by the way, but it's really the kids and the children that carry the message of the Asha hope, if you like. Let me tell you what those 10 values are. And if you ask any kid in an Asha slum, what are the values, they will be able to tell you. And if you ask them not just what are the values, but what do they mean to you and how do you implement these, they can tell you that as well. And the reason why I know that is because we saw lots of kids and lots of mums and lots of women, and we asked those same questions every time. So don't tell me about, you know, what they are, because, you know, Indian children will learn by rote, and that's quite a common thing. But actually, what does it look like in your life? So let me tell you what those 10 values are. Gratitude, generosity, compassion, non-violence, simplicity, justice, empowerment, joy, dignity, positive thinking. Come on, people! You know, these are amazing. You know, these are kids that have got nothing, and they are living by these values. I want my kids to live by that value, those values, don't you? Let me just pick one or two of them for you. So you say to a slum kid, what does generosity look like in your life? And they will say, as our little kind of kids group, which are called Bal Mandals, we all put 5 rupees in a pot once a month. And if somebody is struggling in our slum, so maybe there's a lady who's had her husband die, or they're starving, or they can't afford to do a proper burial for that person, or, you know, there's some reason, they've probably might have just fallen poorly, they will go in person to that person in their slum, give them money, or they'll go and buy rice for them at least, take it to their house and say, we will help you. You know, you kind of think of, you know, very, 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 very poor people, and then reaching out to the poor people. You know, it's always kind of like, we kind of laugh about, you know, people in their 80s who go and help the old people, don't we? And, you know, but this is the same sort of thing, isn't it? That, you know, the extraordinarily poor people reach out to poor people. That's how they define their generosity. I love it. I love being in that environment. I love being in a place where, you know, it you can see it You can watch it. You can see it develop. We've seen over time that, you know, the we didn't realize it was kind of 1991 that we had been involved with them, but that it began. But, you know, over the years and the times that we've gone back, we can see how the slums are developing, and it is fantastic. And we are part of their legacy because of what, you know, our role has been. Big or small, it doesn't matter. But we've played a role, and their legacy is my legacy. And so just an example of that, one of the slums that we have worked into quite a lot is one called Mayapuri. It is still shocking to go to Mayapuri and see the dirt. You can't ignore it, because one side, there's a railway track and trains go along it. It is a working railway. And the other side is a breaker's yard. So everything is about dirt. It's about oil. It's about muck that is just unbelievable. And yet you've got these lovely people who live amongst all of this just awful stuff working out these 10 values. It's really difficult to have joy amongst the dirt, you know, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how do you do this? But they do. But their legacy is my legacy. And so currently in the Asher, they run a polyclinic, which is a bit like a kind of cottage hospital. One of the lab assistants is a lad from Mayapuri. Now, I didn't save this lad, but what I would have done was contributed to an immunisation programme that would have meant that he was immunised against typhoid, cholera, you know, polio, that meant that he got an education, that meant he went through college, that meant he became a lab assistant in the polyclinic. That's my legacy, and I think it's brilliant. You don't have to, that's fine. They have these 10 values, but then they added one. So they're still called the 10 values, even though there are 11, which is really funny. And the last one is touch. And so to be able to touch people when you're in those situations is really important. Now, to be really honest with you, I'm a selective hugger, okay? I do not feel the need to walk around a room and hug everybody in the room because I'm a selective hugger, okay? But when I go to Asher, the most powerful thing sometimes I can do, and certainly in the absence of language, I don't speak a word of Hindi, as you probably realised, but I will get a dirty child, a filthy child, and I will put it on my lap. You don't need language, do you? You know, they're just kids. They're just kids. Let me tell you about Selangor. Selangor is actually a slum. I will finish with this, just in case you're watching the time, John. Sorry. It's a slum that Asher have worked in for many, many years. Okay, it's about the size in terms of geography as Marlow. The population of Marlow, I think, is about 14,000. Somebody nod. At least 40,000 live in Marlow. Okay, just to give you a perspective of, you know, what that might look like when you're, you know, queuing at something and you're thinking, all these people, for goodness sakes. This slum is just up the road, and it's called New Selangor. And Asher have just started work in there, because that New Selangor is actually built, the slum, on a riverbed. There is a problem with that, because the river rises. And when I say they have nothing. I mean, there are no toilets, so they have to go and find a corner. And, you know, every slum has used to have a like, poo corner or something. You know, they just go there. If that's offensive, get over it. But, you know, that's what happens. The danger to women going to some random bit of grass or ground, or, you know, is huge. It's absolutely huge. They don't have electricity. There is nothing there. It is dirt. And, you know, you can see. Nobody collects their rubbish. And this is where people live. And the photograph of me holding Sumat, who is, he's a month old. I've never had to raise my kids in that. I've never had to raise them and keep them safe and feed them in that level of squalor. And, you know, when the river rises, they move to the road. And the road is the equivalent of moving onto the hard shoulder of the 404. How can you look at the hard shoulder of the 404 and go, that's a great place to live? That's a great place to raise my kids. You have to be desperate. You have to be properly desperate to be able to think that's a good idea. And then at the point where the river recedes again, they move back to the riverbed. I love going to Asher because I see hope. Despite all of that muck, despite all of that, you know, Asher change things with people. They don't change things for people and they don't do it to them. They change things with people, and I love going to see it. There's a possibility that Andrew and I might take a team out next year. If you're interested, come and talk to me. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, guys. John, do you want to come and quickly share?
Yeah. Good. Sometimes God puts something on your heart and in your mind, and you feel it, you keep thinking about it, you keep seeing things about it, and really, you have to do it. Now, quite often, this is you having to take a step outside of your comfort zone, which I'm sure Andrew and Linda do when they go to India, but they do it anyway. I was involved. I think the first open thing I heard about Afghanistan, there was a book by Floyd McClung, who was one of the leaders in YWAM, and he followed the hippie trail from Holland through to Afghanistan, and so Afghanistan stuck in my mind. Then I read an article in the Telegraph, it was quite a long time ago, it was before the Russians went in there, saying that Afghanistan is an ungovernable country, and it went through from Genghis Khan to Alexander the Great, to the British Empire, to the, well, then subsequently the Russians, and people said, why on earth would the Russians be wanting to go to Afghanistan? And so we have in our minds this sort of picture of Afghanistan as probably not a particularly nice place, where the Taliban are there and killing people, blowing people up, where women have to wear all this sort of kit so that they can see out but nobody can see them. And so we have this perception, and I've got involved with an organisation called Serve Afghanistan because it was just a series of rather miraculous events, actually, and I thought, well, okay, let's sort of flow with this, and then I did, and then I thought, well, it's all very well being on a board of a charity, but if you don't actually know what the charity does, if you haven't actually been to the coalface, if you like, then really, how can you make any really good decisions about the things that they're dealing with? It's an extraordinary place. I got on the aeroplane with a guy called Andy Dipper, who's the principal. Oh, there we are. That's good. Can you go back one? That's it. That's the Afghan flag. And, yeah, and the next one. Yeah, that's what Afghanistan looks like when you get there. And the next picture is just a beautiful place. That's coming down towards the border with Pakistan. And we went down to the place called Jalalabad, and you come down from about 5,000 feet down to sea level, and that's the sort of views that you get. So it really is. It's quite an extraordinary place. So we flew into Kabul. I was feeling a bit nervous, although I had a sense of assurance, I have to say, and all of your prayers were of great help to me. But, you know, we got there. We landed at the Hamid Karzai airport, and you have to walk about 1/4 mile from the airport terminal to get to the where the car park is, because they don't want people. Thank you. They don't want people blowing people up. And so you get there and you get into your vehicle. The security, you do have to be quite careful. Fortunately, when I was there, there were no bombs in Kabul. The week afterwards, there were three and lots of gunfire. But fortunately, while we were there, we were covered. And I felt very grateful I felt the support of all of you as I was there. There were various people who gave me prophetic words. And Lina had one about an angel going with me. And when I was in Dubai about to get on the plane to Kabul and I got upgraded to business class, I thought that was a serious angel. So, serve Afghanistan. There are about 220 Afghan people operating out of three centres, one in Kabul, one in Jalalabad, which is over on the Pakistan border, and one in Kandahar, which is closer to the Iranian border. There are about 7 international people who are there. They are specialists in particular areas of the work. And when we went there, I wanted to do 2 things. One, I wanted to talk to a lot of people, see what their issues were, what they were particularly proud of. I wanted to see the work that was going on, and I wanted to encourage everybody, particularly some of the international people, because at the moment they're all women there, and if any guys who want to go out, they'd be very welcome, just to balance it out a bit. But they're very, very brave people. They're all in their 20s and early 30s. And they're extremely brave people. They're operating in different communities with different people. SERV has a number of different projects. It's involved in community development and also in reaching out to people who have disabilities. Now, something I didn't realise until yesterday, actually, there wasn't a Disability Act in the UK until 1995. Can you believe that? So people who had any sort of disabilities, blind or deaf or mentally handicapped, they were really disadvantaged. Well, they're still disadvantaged in Afghanistan, but this charity goes to reach out to help them. One of the projects they have, they go to towns and to villages. And I went over to Jalalabad, north of Jalalabad. There are lots of mountain villages. Typical village will have 10 to 12 families living in it. And in those particular ones, they speak a language called Pashtai, which has no written form. The normal languages are probably Pashtun and Dari. And so they went into the villages and they had a program where they, in the more hilly places, they provide goats. In the towns, they provide cows. And the idea is that you go to the Shura Council, which is the local government, not government really, it's a community group. And within, you say to the community leaders, who's the poorest person in your village? And they show them who they are, and then they give them a cow. They also have a travelling bull, who's a very thoroughbred sort of bull, and all these cows get pregnant, and they're giving milk, and the people in the families, they can use the milk for their families. They can also sell it. They make it into butter or whatever, and they can sell it in the town. All the guys, all the male cows get butchered and sold for meat. Well, you know, it's just tough, really, being a guy sometimes. And anyway, when the cow delivers the little cow, they stay with the family until they're 18 months old, and then they go to the second poorest family in the village, and they give them the cow, and so the process goes on. They've been working for 35 years, and they've got They've got quite a lot of families now with cows. But because they've done this in these different communities, the communities have opened up to them, and they have really good... it means that they can do more in the communities because there's the trust. You get a village and they'll say to the... they'll phone up the Serb people, the Afghan leaders of the work there, and say, "Why haven't you come to our village yet? Yeah, we want you to come to our village." And so they have this huge sort of cooperation within it. And then they can go to them and they can say, well, they have very high infant mortality there. It really is. There's very little by way of drainage or anything else. But it means they've got the access to deliver other programs. So it really is quite exciting. One of the other problems they have is because the villages are quite small and people are quite concerned, there's a lot of intermarriage between family members, and as a result of that there's a disproportionate amount of sickness, and one of the projects that Serve has is called SHIP, and the SHIP project gathers deaf and blind kids, and they teach them. And they teach them sign language, they teach them to read. They get them to the stage where they can get into the mainstream schools. And some of these kids who've come through these programs go on to university, which has been great. These are some girls in Jalalabad. I went to this place, and I'm not sure what they were. They're either deaf or blind. But I went to a class, and they had all these little kids. They must have been about 5 years old, and they were all trying to show off to us. And the deaf kids, they'd learnt sign language, and so they said, you know, you come up and show us your sign. And they would sign the alphabet like this. And there was one guy who was really keen to make sure that he was the fastest sign language alphabet person around. But the good thing that is, these kids would normally just be kept at home because it's embarrassing to have a child who is disabled in that community. But it's moved on. So these kids are coming out. They are interacting with each other, and they interact so well. When I was in Jalalabad, they were playing blind cricket, and it's just amazing what they can do and how they hear where the ball is. It's just all very, very, very exciting. Sometimes they can't get to a central location, so they've got a whole program where you have a house and somebody will have a disabled child within the house, and then they gather other children who have similar situations. They'll come to the house and then they'll teach them in that. I went to one which is actually in Kabul, in this quite a grotty sort of area, but it was fascinating listening to. There was a 14-year-old girl who was blind. There was a younger guy, and he was doing reading Braille, and she was, although she's blind herself, she was reading the same thing at the same time, and she was correcting him whenever he got a particular word wrong. But it was just extraordinary. It's just extraordinary to watch. So I think what I want to challenge everybody is with this verse. We've talked about it before when we've been talking about outreach and evangelism. I really encourage all of you at some point today to say, "Lord, yeah, here am I, send me." And then be open for him to send you wherever he feels you want to be. It may be to get involved with the ASHA programs. It may be to get involved with things in Malawi. It may be to get involved with things in Afghanistan. It may be to get involved with things in Malo or in other parts of the country. But we need to be open to step out of our comfort zones, take a bit of a risk, and to move forward. I want to redefine normal. I want it to be that when kids get to, either they leave school or they leave university, one of the things on the top of their must-do list is to go and spend some time out in a mission situation somewhere, reaching out to people who are less fortunate than themselves. I'd really like to see that happening. And we as a church, I'd like to be able to support them. So if we have kids who are growing up and they want to go and get involved in mission, we as a church gather around and say, well, look, we want to support you. Here's some finance to do that. I want to encourage people, when they come back, to honour them for the things that they've done and to just get the just benefit from all of that as our eyes are open. Next year, it was good to hear that Andrew and Linda want to take people to Asher. I want to have a River Church mission trip to Albania, where we've been before. And I would be very happy for us to take, 15, 20 people over to Albania and to be involved in mission there. I've had my first person sign up, that's Dave. So start thinking about that. When you're saying, here am I, send me, start that. That's the heading of your prayer. And then think about all these different things. Think about all the things that you can do to get involved. Because my experience is when you go, it doesn't just bless the people, it actually transforms you. I wanted to encourage all the helpers there, and we had a lot of opportunity to do that. And I was thinking about communion here. We were over in Jalalabad, and there were two girls there, Megan and Cornelia, who've been doing phenomenal work there. We were having dinner with them, and then I really felt that we needed to take communion. And I looked around, and there was no wine, and there was no bread. But what we did have was water and bananas. So we break this banana. And so we had a great time. They were really encouraged. I'm sure they'll remember the event. The last thing is this. There are lots of agencies that will get you started. This is All Nations Bible School. Andy Dipper, who is with me, he's the principal of this. They run all manner of courses. This is a five-day course, just to give you a bit of an idea about what mission work might be like. They do longer courses, and they take you all the way up to a master's degree, I think, in mission. And I would encourage you, if you really feel that God putting this on your heart, to come and talk to me, and I can put you in touch with that. But let's be a missionary church.
Good. Well done, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Linda. And thank you, John.